Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Brilliantly, I can't believe the sun is actually shining outside. This is MJ Network after my sister, Marcia Joyce, who I miss terribly, but I'm very proud to say she made me do this. But before I forget, I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to the people at Northwell Urgent Care for taking such good care of me yesterday and putting up with my jokes. Seriously. So thank you to the gorgeous radio technologist, Mo, to Dr. Dulcie, she is absolutely better than any primary doctor, to Tracy for laughing at my jokes this morning, and to the handsome guy that took my blood, George. They are absolutely the best. So if you're ever up in Tarrytown, that's where you want to go. And if you sign in online like me, you don't have to wait. Isn't that cool? Before I forget, yeah, we have the author of The Voice Inside, and I hope that The Voice Inside is listening to you because Rudy Cutter is dangerous. And Frost Easton, well, he realizes that his friend planted some false evidence to put him behind bars, not that he didn't belong there. Now, it's up to you to decide whether he did the right thing or the wrong thing because he scared the daylights out of me. And Brian Freeman is here. Hi, good morning. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. It's always great to be here with you, Fran.
Yeah, this is great. This book scared me, but you know what? Alter Ego scared me even more. That was really good. Oh boy.
I always like to make sure that you're checking under the bed and making sure the doors are locked before you go to sleep at night.
That's pretty much what I was going to write in my review. Yeah, seriously, I can't believe I did that. Yeah. But so when creating the major premise for this book, how did you create the conflict for Frost Easton? Because that's a hard one. He knew the guy was guilty, but yet he knew he had to do something about it. Why did he do it?
Yeah. You know, I always love to find those sorts of interesting moral questions at the base of, mm-hmm. of my books. And when you first meet Frost Easton in The Nightbird, that was the book that came out last year. It's the first in the Frost Easton series. In fact, The Nightbird was one of the top 20 Kindle bestsellers of 2017, so I'm awfully proud of that.
Oh wow!
But when you first meet Frost in The Nightbird, one of the key things that you learn about him, and one of the real motivators in his past, is the fact that his sister Katie was murdered several years earlier, and it was really that incident that sort of propelled him into police work. And I knew that in the second Frost book that I was going to deal with the issue of Frost and Katie, and that was going to kind of come back into his life. But I was looking at the conflict involved, and there have been some interesting stories, you know, in the news over the past few years about some incidents where there was either false testimony or false evidence that had appeared in cases that ultimately resulted in people going to prison. And so I thought about, well, what would happen and how would Frost deal with the idea that if he discovered that some of the evidence that was used to put his sister's killer in prison turned out to be falsified, and could he live with that? Could he live with a lie? And the fact about Frost is he is the kind of character that he's a little bit of a Boy Scout, as some of the characters will say, and he ultimately concludes that he can't just sit back. He knows that Rudy Cutter is guilty. He knows that this is the man that murdered his sister, and yet he can't stand by and allow basically a miscarriage of justice to happen. And so he's got to expose what his friend and colleague on the San Francisco police did in essentially framing Rudy Cutter. And they were framing the correct villain, but nonetheless, they were committing a crime in doing so. So I just love the moral dynamics and dimensions of Frost having to deal with this situation where by doing the right thing, by exposing a wrong committed by someone in the police force, at the same time, a terrible event happens as a result of that in that a killer goes back on the street.
Yeah, but I'm wondering in real life if somebody really would have done that.
I don't know. That's a good question. I think more often than not they probably would, but I'm sure there are also circumstances where those kind of things get covered up and you never hear about them. I mean, that's the whole essence behind you know, the Innocence Project, is that there are folks that are in prison that were wrongfully convicted. And sometimes it was simply something as quote unquote simple as witness misidentification. But, you know, there have certainly been instances where, people on the police and in the prosecutor's office become so convinced of the certainty of someone's guilt that they're willing to cross a moral line in falsifying evidence or putting forward things that aren't necessarily true, or keeping things back that are exculpatory. And the fact is, at some point or another, those things have a way of coming out, whether it's somebody inside the police that can't live with it, or it's someone on the outside that finds out what was really going on.
Yeah, I know, and that was what I said to myself. Now, why would he want to do that? And why in heaven blazes would he want to do something like that? Because he knows.
Yeah, and certainly it's not something he wants to do, but he feels he has no choice.
Actually, you're right. He didn't. But I wonder today, after what listening to on the news and everything, and all these police officers that didn't do what they were supposed to do, you wonder sometimes. So he pieces it together. Who is Jess, and when did Frost realize that she was the reason that Rudy Cunningham went to prison?
Well, you know, I always say that I never write about supervillains, but Rudy Cutter comes pretty much as close as just about any character I've created to being a supervillain. I mean, he's a man that is bad and ruthless, and interestingly, I think throughout the course of the book you get a sense of who he really is as a person. And I don't like to write characters who are just kind of bad to the bone. You learn a lot about what happened that created Rudy Cutter into the person that he is. But he is a character that does these terrible things, and the lead investigator in these series of murders in San Francisco was a woman named Jess Salceda, and Jess was Frost's boss on the police force, and she's the one that ultimately concludes that she knows that Rudy Cutter is guilty. She knows that he's doing this, and yet she can't get the evidence to put him behind bars. And so there's an opportunity that arises. It's sort of like this awful temptation that she suddenly finds herself with an opportunity to do something that theoretically should never be discovered, and would be the evidence that would clearly link Rudy Cutter to this series of murders, and so she also faces this moral line and decides that Cutter is bad enough, and she's sure enough of his guilt that she's willing to put evidence in play that is actually falsified, and she plants it and convinces herself that the ends justify the means.
Well, there are a lot of people that would have a hard time not doing what she did, maybe, knowing that he's guilty.
Well, I think that's I think that's right. I think that's the issue. Yeah. that people know that the justice system is intended to say that it's better to have 9 guilty people go free than to have, you know, 1 innocent person convicted. And yet it's easy to say that in theory when you're confronted with a guilty party and a terrible series of crimes. And I think that's what drives Jess across this moral line. And you know, that's the same kind of line then that Frost faces. And he comes very close to the edge. I mean, one of my favorite scenes very early on in this book is Frost in the middle of the night with this evidence in his hand is going out into the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge, and all he has to do to make this all go away is just let this evidence slip out of his hand and go into the water, and he just finds that he can't do it. He can't live with a lie, and he doesn't think that his sister would want him living with a lie, and that you know, she wouldn't want that to be the kind of person he's become.
That's scary. So what is his relationship with Jess outside of work, and this is going to, of course, it's going to affect us. He has to decide whether he's going to turn her in or not.
Well, that complicates the situation too, because Frost and Jess have a bit of baggage on their own, because Frost joined the police really at Jess's instigation. They got to know each other during the investigation of his sister's murder, and Jess saw something in Frost that she thought would work on the police force. And ultimately, it's something I think that in some ways comes back to haunt her because of the person that Frost is. But they have this love-hate relationship between them, and they're not meant to be together. They're not, you know, two people that could ever be a couple, and yet there's this heat between them as well. And one time after Jess had split from her husband, they sort of fell off the wagon and had a very brief affair together. And again, they knew it was not something that was going to be long-term, and these are not two people that really could ever be together. And yet they constantly feel themselves drawn together, and they've got that sort of physical reminder in their past that there's something between them. So they're not just colleagues. There's also a level of connection between them that they can't really get away from.
Well, you know, I did read the Innocence Project. I did review the book. All of those cases, I read every single one of them. Philip Margolin sent me to review. And I was like, oh, my God, this is so horrible. All those people that were innocent. So, I mean, I wonder sometimes if the police find a suspect and that's it. They don't look any further sometimes. That's what's
yeah,
scary.
That is always the concern. I mean, you know, being on the outside of this, you like to think that you know, kind of justice always prevails in you know, in one way or another. That the innocent people go free and the guilty people go to prison. But it's a little more complicated than that in real life.
Well, when you hear Rudy Cutter's voice, God, he's scary. Tell us about Rudy Cutter and Hope, and he sort of knew he was going to get out. That's what was really scary. He didn't even know that he was going to be there that much longer.
Yeah, you know, I really had an interesting time creating Rudy Cutter's character. As I say, I really don't like having sort of supervillains in my books, and I kind of think that in general, you know, serial killers are kind of a cop out for writers, because it sort of theoretically absolves you from having to explain why they you know, turned out the way they did and why they do what they do. Well, they're just bad to the bone. And I never believe that in general, that there's always, you know, there's always something that kind of pushed someone over the edge. So I spent a lot of time trying to build out how Rudy Cutter sort of disintegrated as a human being. And it starts with a horror that he went through in his marriage, that his wife Hope ultimately did something that essentially sort of, you know, destroyed Rudy's life and left him kind of this hollow shell and left this anger and rage and revenge sort of simmering inside him and getting hotter year by year by year by year, until one little thing, one strange little thing, sets him off and sets him on this very grotesque new path as a killer. But what I wanted, you know, I mean, Rudy has a lot of scenes in this book himself. I mean, the narrative goes back and forth between Frost and Rudy, and as a result, I needed Rudy, for as awful and horrible as he is, to have a certain degree of sympathy, maybe too much, but for the reader to sort of be fascinated by him and to really, you know, understand how he became the terrible person that he is, because they have to spend a lot of time with this person and it's horrifying. And yet they also, I think, you know, come out of the book with a sense of, you know, who he really is and the horror that he went through along the way.
He seems to have so much self-confidence in himself, this Rudy Cutter, that he's frightening. He actually believes that he can do almost anything and not get caught.
That's true. I mean, Rudy, you know, and I think possibly it's that he doesn't necessarily care about getting caught. I mean, he's pursuing his goal, and he doesn't really seem influenced by everything going on around him. But of course, the thing about Rudy is that he knows that the evidence in that case was planted. What he doesn't know is how exactly it happened. But he's pretty well convinced right from the get-go that he's going to be able to figure out a way to make this all come back on the police.
I know, and then the police are not going to be happy, and neither is the judge, but that's too bad. So we hear his voice in the first chapter, and we know that he's scary. How do we know that he broke into Forrest's house? That was even scarier. He comes home and he realizes something's not right. And
yeah,
not right.
I love the first chapter of The Voice Inside. It's one of my favorite first chapters because there you have Frost asleep in his San Francisco house, and he wakes up in the middle of the night. Something feels wrong. There's something out of whack in the house, and his first thought, because he's a San Franciscan, is that this there must be an earthquake starting, and yet then he realizes it's not an earthquake. It's that someone has been inside the house and someone has just left. And so he's trying to figure out what's going on. He searches the house, and he can't find anyone inside. But then, strangely, all these alarm clocks start ringing, and all over the house, suddenly alarm clocks start going off, and they're all set to the same exact time. And that time, 3:42 a.m., is the time that was set on the watch of every single victim of Rudy Cutter. And so that's how Frost knows that suddenly this man has kind of come back to life.
That's even scarier. And then the last time I looked for 3:42, I just got really scared and got up and said, let me make myself some coffee and make sure no one's here. No, seriously. Seriously, I got luck. Now, my favorite character in the book is Shaq. How come he has to take care of him? And I like Shaq. He's a cool character.
I love Shaq, and you're right. I think Shaq is maybe the most popular character in the Frost series. He first arrived in the Nightbird, and everyone fell in love with Shaq, and he's equally popular in The Voice Inside. Shaq is Frost's cat. And he's not only Frost's cat, but strangely, he is Frost's landlord because Frost, a couple years earlier, had responded to a homicide investigation at this very, very nice upscale home in the Russian Hill neighborhood of San Francisco. So kind of up in the sky with this beautiful view down over the city, and there was this older woman who had been killed by a home invasion, an intruder, and the police weren't able to get to the body because her cat was guarding the body and wouldn't let anyone get close. And Frost just kind of sat down and started talking to the cat, and in that moment the cat decided to adopt Frost and sort of walked away from the woman and climbed up on Frost's shoulder, and so Frost and Shaq kind of found each other, and then Frost discovered this rather odd provision in the woman's will that anyone who adopted Shaq would be able to live in her Russian Hill home for the amazing San Francisco rent of $1 per year, as long as the person was taking care of Shaq in the house. And so that's where Frost is. He's living in Russian Hill now with Shaq, and it's technically not his house. It's Shaq's house. And so I just think that's such a fun thing. And I love the relationship between Frost and Shaq. I mean, you can tell that Frost just, you know, absolutely loves this cat, and the cat, you know, he takes the cat along a lot of times when he's off on his investigations. And it's a fun little thing about Frost, who is otherwise kind of a loner as a character. He doesn't, you know, hang out with a lot of other folks on the police. Many of the folks that he deals with in terms of sources are are actually outside the police force, and he doesn't really fit in with the sort of police mystique, and yet, you know, there he has this cat with him, and I think it helps readers sort of get a sense of the kind of man Frost is, and so I just love that relationship.
Well, we've got Wren, and we've got something about Rudy. What about the victims? What about them are all the same? And who was Wren? And when his child died, he sort of went off a nut, didn't he?
Well, and that's the thing. Wren is Rudy Cutter's daughter, and the horrible incident in Rudy's past is that his wife Hope murdered their child, and that's really the incident that Rudy can't escape, and it keeps it becomes kind of the fundamental driving force of his life. Not just losing his daughter, but also the revenge and the complex relationship with his wife. In terms of what she did, which was as much to get back at him as against his daughter, and Wren sort of follows Rudy everywhere, and yet so does Hope, and it leaves the police wondering, you know, at least Jess and Frost wondering what really was it that drove Rudy to choose his victims, and that's kind of the essential mystery of the book is that they all believe that there is some motivating factor that Rudy chose these particular victims, and yet Jess in her investigation and Frost in his investigation, he can't find the missing link. All of the victims seem completely unrelated. They're different ages. They're different races. They live in different parts of the city. There doesn't seem to be they don't have any overlap in terms of where they've been or who they've been in contact with. So there's nothing that kind of ties these people together, and that essentially is the mystery that Frost needs to figure out is how is Rudy choosing these people, and of course how does Frost's own sister Katie fit into that mix, because Katie was one of Rudy's victims, and yet Katie doesn't seem to fit the pattern, and it's the one that doesn't fit sometimes that can lead you to the truth.
Well, we've got a character that I didn't like, and that would be Eden. I didn't like her from the start, and I, like Frost, didn't trust her. So why does she worm her way into this investigation, and what was she trying to write about? And he didn't really trust her, so why did she?
I think Frost is slow to trust most people, Eden's a fascinating character. She's not part of the police. She's a writer, and she writes nonfiction books, and she's in the process of writing a book about Rudy Cutter, and she's interviewed Rudy Cutter in prison, and as a result, sort of knows more about him than most other people, because she's had the opportunity to be face to face with Rudy and talking about his crimes. And so when Cutter actually gets out of prison, Eden finds Frost and offers to help him, to help be a part of the investigation, because she kind of knows how Rudy thinks. But she's got a bit of a price tag that goes along with that, in that she wants to be embedded with Frost in his investigation and wants to be right there, sort of like a war correspondent. She wants to be the voice inside, and wants to be there with Frost as he's pursuing this investigation, and ultimately sort of becomes embedded with Frost in more ways than one, and that relationship becomes problematic.
She's toxic, that's all I can say. And I tried to warn him throughout the book to stay away from her, but he would not listen. You know how he is. What can I say? Not good. So we've got Tabby and Dwayne. That's his brother. And his parents were thrilled about it. How did Frost feel about it, that he was dating somebody?
Yeah, I really enjoy the sort of side characters in Frost's life, and Dwayne is one of them. Dwayne is his brother, and he's several years older than Frost, but he almost comes across, I think, as a little bit more boyish and impulsive than Frost himself. And Dwayne is a chef. He's one of the top chefs of the city. He used to own a very successful San Francisco restaurant, and then ultimately he sold it and opened up a food truck in a little street food park in San Francisco, and now he's sort of best known for his food truck in the city. So Dwayne showed up in The Nightbird and was part of that book, and now he's back in The Voice Inside, and he has a steady girlfriend now, which is pretty shocking to Frost, because Dwayne has not exactly been known for the stability of his relationships, and typically he kind of goes from one sous chef to another, and his relationships are just kind of a substitute for his career, and yet here we have Tabby Blaine that Frost meets, and Dwayne has sort of been secretly dating her for several months and is falling in love with her, and Frost he's pleased but also rather shocked that Dwayne is in a steadier relationship, because he never thought he'd see that happen with his brother. But the trouble for Frost is that he feels a bit of an attraction to Tabby too, and that there's this chemistry between them. And Frost is someone, he doesn't go looking for relationships. You know, he's not like Jonathan Stride, who always sort of has a woman in his life. Frost has avoided relationships for most of his life. He doesn't really think he's very good at them, and yet here is this woman who's very seriously dating his brother, and he finds that this strange and rather scary chemistry with her, and he's obviously trying to kind of push that down and run away from it, but of course we know that's not how emotions work.
I won't say more than that. I was very not surprised, but I wouldn't like the fact that she was going to tweet on Dwayne. That's not very good. But, you know, that's how they, what could you do? Anyway, we have Katie. And what did his family think when he heard that Cutter was getting out? How did his family react to that?
Clearly Dwayne and Frost's parents are you know, hugely upset, as all of the families of the victims are, at the idea that you know, Rudy Cutter is getting out of prison. They all believe he's guilty. They are shocked at the idea that this man's going to be back on the streets. And of course, the first reaction of everyone is he's going to start right back in his list of victims. And of course, as you know, folks do, nobody's very happy with Frost for bringing to light the false evidence that put Rudy Cutter in prison. And as far as his family is concerned, as far as most of the victims' families are concerned, Frost should have just stayed quiet and not let any of this happen. And so Frost feels this obligation, because he was the one that let this happen, and he was the one that brought this evidence to light. He wants to find a way to get Cutter back in prison and to stop him, even though really he has to pursue this kind of on the side, because being a family member of one of the victims, he can't really sort of openly go after Cutter himself. And so behind the scenes, he's trying to figure out what he can do to anticipate Cutter's next moves and find evidence that would put him back in prison. But of course, it becomes a cat and mouse game between Frost and Cutter throughout the book.
I know, that was really scary though, because he wasn't done yet. So who is Herb, and why does he go out of his way to help Frost?
Well, as I say, you know, I really enjoy the cast of characters around Frost. You know, Dwayne, this kind of boyish chef, and then there's Herb. Herb's a bit of a San Francisco institution. Kind of a reformed flower child from the 1960s. He was part of the Summer of Love back in 1968. And he's Frost's best friend, and they are very unlikely. You know, here's Herb, who is twice as old as Frost is. He's almost 70. He has, you know, long gray hair with beads knitted into his hair, and he's had a variety of lives that he's lived in San Francisco. He was on the city council. He was a biologist, and now he's gained fame as a three-dimensional sidewalk painter. He paints these elaborate sidewalk murals where the images seem to come to life out of the sidewalk and look as if they're three-dimensional, even though they're painted on the sidewalk. And one of the things about Herb is that he's very active in San Francisco, and he had created this initiative to get smartphones in the hands of the homeless, so they had resources to be able to find shelters and tip lines for jobs and things like that. And one of the results of that is that there's kind of this network among the homeless population in the city that they call Street Twitter, and Herb is kind of tapped into that network. And so when Frost needs to find someone in the city, or he needs information about what's going on the street, he uses Herb as a resource to be able to put the word out on the network and find information often faster than he can through any other source.
Well, tell us, what was Katie doing the night she was killed, or supposedly doing the night she was killed?
Well, Katie, Frost's sister, this terrible thing happened, Katie was working at a pizza place in the Haight-Ashbury, and she was delivering pizzas, and Frost was on the phone with her that last night and making jokes with her, and she had a pizza delivery to make, and she went out that night and never came back. She was never seen again until Frost then was the one that discovered her body, and so Frost never understood how she got targeted and how she was found and why she showed up on Rudy Cutter's list, and it's this mystery that only deepens as he starts reinvestigating everything, because he begins to find that you know, Katie was doing things that didn't make any sense, and something was strange about that last delivery she made, but he can't quite figure out what was really going on and what was it that sort of put her in the crosshairs of Rudy Cutter.
I know, that's what's really scary. So, who is Hayden? And Frost was investigating this case, so why did he want him to back off, but yet not really? He wasn't going to come down on him.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, you know, Frost isn't exactly tuned into the police network, and he doesn't really have a lot of friends among the police force outside of Jess. And then there's Captain Hayden, Pruitt Hayden, who is a very, very large man and kind of a large, intimidating former Stanford linebacker. And Captain Hayden also has the unfortunate distinction of being Jess's ex-husband. And so not surprisingly, given the relationship between Jess and Frost, Captain Hayden and Frost are not exactly allies. So Hayden is not really a fan of Frost sticking his nose into this investigation, and yet he also knows that Frost is smart and committed and he's passionate about finding the answer here. But you know, Hayden doesn't want to do anything that's going to screw up this investigation, and he's a political animal. He has his eyes set on. Higher political office inside the police department, and he knows with Rudy Cutter back on the street, this is sort of a disaster for everyone on the police force and in the prosecutor's office. And what he certainly doesn't want is to have another rogue cop out there. And so on one hand, he's trying to sort of rein Frost in and make sure he doesn't do something that screws up the investigation. On the other hand, he also is kind of quietly giving Frost the green light to go out and try to find the truth. But he also makes sure Frost knows that he's on his own. And if he screws up, he's going to get cut loose.
Well, we can't have that because he's a really good character. But not as good as Jonathan Stryver and Campbell.
Well,
and see,
I knew you were going to put those two together. He's very different. I mean, you know, Stride has this very dark, intense determination, and Frost is, you know, Frost is a little bit more of the Boy Scout. He's a little more naive. I think he's very engaging because he's so different, and it'll be fun to kind of see him evolve as the books go on.
Well, you paired up my two favorite hunks, Cab Bolton and Jonathan Stride. Now, I wonder what happened if you paired the three of them up. Oh, my God. That might be interesting.
Well, yes, Jonathan Stride is back on May 1st in Alter Ego. So everyone has to read The Voice Inside quickly now because they don't have to wait very long before the new book is out. Alter Ego will be out May 1st. And when I was developing Alter Ego as a book, the essential plot idea for Alter Ego actually started in my head as a book that might work for Cab Bolton. Cab, of course, is the hero in my books, The Bone House and Season of Fear. And people have been asking me now for a couple of years, well, when are we going to see Cab again? And as I was developing the Stride book, Alter Ego, it occurred to me that the most natural thing in the world was for this plot line to also fit in Cab Bolton. And so this Alter Ego becomes my first crossover book, and you have the opportunity not only to meet Jonathan Stride again, but you'll also have the opportunity to meet Cab Bolton again. And that was just a lot of fun, being able to have both characters in the same book. They're such completely different men as heroes and detectives, people have been asking about this for a few years, and have asked about, you know, would there be any kind of crossover, I always said that if I ever brought them together, that sort of the natural two that might find each other would be Maggie and Cab, and sure enough, that's really the essence of the connection that brings Cab into the book is Maggie's really the one that sort of finds Cab and develops some connections with him.
I know, but I sort of heard what happened at the end of the book, and I don't know what you're going to do next, but I have my own thoughts. Yeah, he's really cool. I like him. So when Frost meets Josephine, Hope's mother, she doesn't want to talk to him. How come?
Yeah, I think that when you look at how a tragedy affects people in the family, here you have this woman Hope that did a horrific thing years earlier, and I think as a parent, Josephine Hope's mother, she doesn't want to go back over this ground. It was years earlier. She certainly struggled with it her whole life. She feels like this incident essentially killed her husband, that he couldn't deal with the guilt and the grief. And it really is, it really is guilt. I think that she's kind of asking herself, you know, well, where did we go wrong? How did we raise this girl that did this awful thing? And so I think it is difficult for her to want to sort of open that up again and believe that what Hope did, you know, could somehow have been connected to what Rudy has been doing, even though it's certainly clear that was the trigger that really that really lit the fire in Rudy Cutter, was what her daughter did. So in some ways, Josephine has some of the answers, but it's a question of can Frost get her to talk about what her daughter was really like.
Well, he seems to know where everybody is, this guy. How does he trick Frost into thinking he was going to kill his date and he took to a concert when in reality he wanted somebody else to be dead? I don't like this guy at all.
Yeah, Cutter's no dummy. I mean, he's a terrible, terrible human being, but he's definitely no dummy. And his you know, he knows when he gets out that you know, every person on the police force is going to be looking for him and following him, and a lot of people in the city are going to be, you know, sort of looking at him as vigilantes and trying to track him down. And so he is very focused on his goals, and also very shrewd about how to misdirect the police and send them in one direction when he goes off in a very chilling different direction, and the results, not surprisingly, are tragic.
Well, I would hate to see what would happen if he came back again. That would not be good. So, if someone were to analyze Rudy's behavior, why does he appear to be justified for his actions? He torments his victims and torments Frost with his phone calls. Why does he think he's right? He's out of his mind.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's I think Rudy, when you look at the fact that so much time went by between the incident that sort of lit the fire for Rudy and his ultimately turning into a killer, it's that, I think, is the essence of who he is, that he sort of died inside for a lot of years, and suddenly strange little incident that brought all of his rage roaring back to life. And I think that he's just focused on that. I don't think he sees anything else. I don't think he sees what he's doing. I don't think he sees the hurt, the emotion, the tragedy, the pain. None of that matters to him. I think he's just... This is somehow a battle between him and Hope's ghost, and that's all he sees, and he can't really process anything that would stop him from what he's doing.
Well, before I forget, and I don't usually forget anything, which is really scary to people. Tomorrow, I don't normally do three shows in 1 week, but Philip Margolin, what can I say, third victim. On Tuesday, one of my favorite people in the whole universe, Larry Thompson, White Witch, what'd you find out about Annie Palmer? She's still roaming around Rose Hall. On 3/8, we have Death Theory by John Mims. If you really want to get scared, read that book. Oh, my God. On the 12th, I'm going to speak out about gun control, and we're going to talk about school safety plans and evacuation. On the 15th, the book is Look for Her. On the 19th, Murder Well Timed. Watch out for your watches. On the 21st, Mark Cameron, who writes for Tom Clancy, has agreed to do an interview with Guess Who. On the 26th, we have Charles Salzberg, Second Story Man. And on the 29th of March, I'm going to do a show dedicated to my mother. My mother had Alzheimer's. And myself, Marcia Cook, and Irene Brodsky, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's, elder care abuse, traumatic brain injury, because my caregiver guide is coming out, I hope, in 2 weeks. And we're going to talk about nursing homes and the kind of care that some people get and the kind of care that they don't get. So that should be interesting. And my mom died of Alzheimer's, and my book, A Daughter's Promise, won best cover for 2017. And, yeah, I can't believe that. And I'm hoping that it gets honorable mention or something for forward book reviews next month. Not bad for a beginner here. So, Rudy says, Arnold Showdown is coming, TikTok. Why did you use that to scare people in me, of course?
Well, I do take a perverse delight in scaring you, friend. That's part of the fun.
I know you do, but it's like, you know, I've been enough alter ego. And wait till you see my review, because I actually defined the word. And I even alluded to some characters that have alter egos. And my favorite alter ego, my favorite book in the whole world, is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you know, I mean, Rudy is all about, Rudy is all about time, and you know, 3:42 a.m. was when his daughter died, and so that's the time he leaves behind on all the other murders, and of course, so when he's getting out and just saying TikTok to Frost, it's very clear that He has no intention of stopping, and he's going to, you know, keep up exactly where he left off. And so Frost knows he's racing the clock. He's racing until that next 3:42 a.m.
I know, and it's funny that you should say that, because that's when I got up this morning to take a Tylenol, exactly, at 3:42.
I think I would have stayed in bed for a couple more minutes, Fran. 3:42 a.m., not a very safe time to be getting up.
I know, and that's when I made the Javalia coffee, and I said, you know, I better stay up and make sure that he's not out there, because I want to make sure I made it to 3:42.
There you go.
So we have, there are betrayals, lies, deceits about to come out, and we learned that Rudy is smarter than we think. Watch out, people. He is really, and you never know, he can reincarnate any minute. So how did you create that final showdown, and why that last victim? And that was really cool. We're not going to say who it is, but oh, my God, that was good.
Yeah, well, I always one of my hallmarks in all my books, and one of the things I like to do to readers is every time you think that you've hit the last twist, there's always one more still to come. So I like to set up the book so that you have this very dramatic, often very emotional finale. But usually, if you glance at the book and realize you've got a few pages left, usually I've got something else waiting in store for you. Even when you look at it and go, well, gee, it seems like all the questions have been answered, I usually try to find one more twist that I can throw your way. So.
Yeah, well, I didn't know he was going to take this person, but that was really clever. And, of course, we get the feeling that Frost has feelings for Tabby. Now, this is the trick question, everybody. Are you going to bring her back? And is he going to screw up his brother's relationship? You know, I had to ask that question to me, because
yes.
You know how many people screwed up around this world.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, as it happens, I have finished the third Frost Easton book. In fact, I'm going to be turning it in to my publisher in the next few days. The title of Frost number 3 is The Crooked Street. And for all of you San Francisco lovers out there, obviously Lombard Street is as popularly known as the crookedest street in the world. But the Crooked Street has a very different meaning in Frost number 3. And I, of course, won't give any secrets away, because you know I would never do that. But all I will say is Dwayne and Tabby will certainly be back in Frost number 3, and we'll just have to see what happens.
Uh-oh. Well, let's hope there's no, it's not a triangle, but then maybe Frost finds his own non-triangle, but that would kill he's not ready yet. And besides, my sister, whenever I met anybody who dated them, we're gonna have to do this to Frost. My sister had the checklist, and she would ask questions and check off the person. And if they didn't meet her criteria, I had to dump them. That was her criteria.
Spoken like a true sister. That's right.
She did. Yeah, my mother was worse. Can I tell you? So how did you create the title, The Voice Inside? And I don't know if you read my review, people, but my review is absolutely brilliant, I think. And it says, Shel Silverstein's title, The Voice Inside, is the inspiration for this title. And I use that in my review, by the way. So I thought that would be a different way to start a review that nobody else in the right mind would do it. So we have, there is a voice inside of you that whispers all day long, I feel this is right for me, I know that this is wrong. No pre-teacher, preacher, parent, friend, or wise man can decide, I think, what is right for you. Just listen to the voice that speaks inside. So I wonder how many of us actually speak. I love Shel Silverstein, by the way. So how come you chose that particular title, and why the voice inside?
I think you'll find this interesting. I actually chose the title The Voice Inside before I even actually knew about Shel Silverstein's poem. I knew that what was going on with these characters was so much driven by things that were going on inside their heads, and true of both Rudy and Frost, that really in both cases they were being driven by the voice inside. Rudy, in his case, it was his wife Hope, and Frost, in a lot of ways, it was his late sister Katie. And then, of course, you have Eden, and Eden is writing this book, and she intends to call it The Voice Inside because she sees this about Rudy Cutter as well. And so when I decided on that as the title for the book, I started doing some research on the phrase The Voice Inside and what do I find but this wonderful Shel Silverstein poem by that title. And I read the poem, and I thought, well, this is absolutely perfect. I mean, that is ultimately the exact quandary that Frost faces. Is it wrong or right to expose what Jess did? And so I end up using it, the fact in the book that this poem was one of Katie's favorite poems as a child, and so Frost in the book knows this poem quite well. And so recognizes that this is what drove Eden to choose this as the title of her book about Rudy Cutter. So it's amazing how, you know, life comes together because, as I say, I had the title before I even knew about the poem, and yet the poem itself just worked beautifully for what the essence of this book was.
Well, the title has a lot of meanings to me. You know, I'm going to come up with something that no one else is going to come up with. And that's what somebody said on their radio show. Like, I come up with something, whatever. It's like you can tell a teenager or a young adult or something, before you do something, listen to that voice inside of you and figure out the consequences before you do them. And obviously,
right.
Frost listened to his little voice inside. I listen to the voice inside of me. It's my mother telling me, don't do that. I'm going to get you, even though I'm up there somewhere. I'll tell you. And my sister used to call me every morning at 7 o'clock. Did you give mom her medicine? I go, aren't you coming in today? And it was like my conscience over there. And even when I do my radio shows, I hear my sister's voice inside of me. Speak slowly. Make sure you have the right questions. And while you're at it, I'm looking over your shoulder to make sure you got it right. It's hilarious. So what does Dwayne, does he really, is he going to get married to her?
Well, we'll just have to see, won't we?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, really. So, what is next for Frost, and will we ever find his own Jane Doe? That was so clever.
Yeah, you know, Frost struggles with relationships, and here the one that seems most interesting to him is one that's completely cut off from him, and how's he going to deal with that? But yes, Frost will be back in The Crooked Street in January, next January. That book is done, you don't have to wait that long for more Brian Freeman, because Stride and Cab will be back in Alter Ego on May 1st, and then next year I'll have a really interesting bonus for people, because my next project is something quite different. I've actually done a deal with Audible to write an audiobook original. And so after The Crooked Street comes out in January later that year, I will have an all-new audiobook original coming out. And I'm looking forward to the creative challenge of writing that, because it'll be something so different writing a book specifically designed for audio. Now, all my books are available in audio right now, but this will be the first one that I did with the idea of a sort of an audiobook exclusive right from the get-go.
Well, of course, you're going to have to print it out for me in order to read it.
Eventually we'll get it into print, but it's going to start out as an audiobook exclusive.
He doesn't do digital ever, ever. I have a lot of people that it's scary, but they just print out the book for me and I go like, oh my God. So if you want to know what I've been reading besides Alter Ego and Dead Air and Well Timed Murder, I got a surprise in the mail today. Brad Meltzer, the escape artist, is in my book thing. And what happens when Fran watches the news? She sits and listens to what's next out. And I didn't realize that the former defense minister of Israel, Moshe Arons, wrote In Defense of Israel. And that showed up this morning, too. Would you believe? And they asked me, believe it or not, if I would like to interview him. And I have to think about that one. I don't know, Brian. What do you think? I'm not sure.
Well, that would make for a fascinating interview. I think you should do it.
Yeah, well, he made for a very difficult interview with the interviewer. And
well,
it
wouldn't be easy, but it would be fascinating. I think you should do it.
I probably will, because I've been doing things that are out of my comfort zone, and that would be different. I have to read the book first and see if I get that hidden message that no one else got. And the interviewer said on television, she's talking to him about different things about Israel, Palestine, Syria, and he was very difficult. And she said 7 times, I didn't read the book, but this is it. I said, why didn't you just read the blurb, have an idea, ask a question about the book at the end? And she's like, well, I can't wait to get off this thing. So we know that that's next and everything. So where can everybody find out about you and your work and everything else? And by the way, everybody, May 7th at 10, learn more about Alter Ego on MJ Network. That would be with me. So what is
I will be back, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. People can find me sort of everywhere online. My website is bfreemanbooks.com. That's all one word, bfreemanbooks.com. You can also find me on Facebook at my Facebook fan page, which is facebook.com/bfreemanfans. You can go out on Twitter and find me under B. Freeman Books. You can find me on Instagram under B. Freeman Books. And you can even have a little fun and go out and find my wife, Marsha, on Facebook. She has a Facebook page called facebook.com/theauthorswife, all one word. And she tells fun little stories from the road as well. So I love interacting with readers. I reply to all the emails I get personally. So when you read my books, be sure to send me an email at brian@bfreemanbooks.com or go to my website at bfreemanbooks.com. There's an email link there. And send me a message and let me know how you like the books.
Well, I can tell you there's about 20 people that are not getting this one. Everybody asks me for my books. And they walk in the elevator and go, what did you read? Or what are you reading now? And they go like, excuse me, Amazon has it on sale just for you. Get a couple of copies of the book. No, my cousin wants this one. She'll get it next. That's who gets it. But I want to thank you so much for today. I'm so glad that you brought back Cab Bolton. And, of course, I like Tarla. I love his mother. She's great.
Yeah, so well, I'm looking forward to being back with you in May and talking in detail about Alter Ego.
Yes, my alter ego is coming out also, I think, eventually. Okay, thank you very, very much. Everybody, have a great day. It's beautiful outside, and bye. Oh, I think I was being tortured. My head. Chawla.